Okay, good morning. It's a speaker's nightmare to have to follow George Grant, but to have to do so with such a thrilling topic as writing your lesson plan. It's just an extra bonus. So, but do welcome. This is a very important part of what we do. And in fact, for classical teachers, it's a little more challenging because we don't have canned curriculum ready to take off the shelf and implement in the classrooms quite as much. And so skill at planning is much more important to us for what we do. So let's pray. Lord God, we thank you for this opportunity to gather together and learn from each other and become better at this calling you've given us of teaching and the craft of teaching. I pray, Lord, that my words will be helpful here, that it will bless those who hear. And Lord, what I say in error or bad advice, I pray, Lord, that it would fall impotently on deaf ears. Thank you, Lord, for your presence among us and for your blessing on all these schools. In Christ's name we pray. Amen. Okay. We're going to go through planning, really from the biggest stage, long-range planning, starting at the beginning, to down to the lesson planning. So we're gonna cover all those today. Lesson plans should drive instruction to accomplish the course objectives. So all your planning really should be objective-driven. You should know what it is you want to accomplish, and lesson plans carry that out for you. One thing I like to tell my teachers is that lesson plans serve teachers. Teachers don't serve lesson plans. So they're for you. They're to help you do your job better. They're not for something else for you to become enslaved to. They don't serve administrators either. Although administrators, we often need to see them, evaluate them, make sure they're getting done. But really, the ultimate purpose of these plans is to serve the teachers as they serve their students. Lesson plans organize your instruction and provide a means for self-evaluation and improvement. Very often, teachers skip that final step of, after a lesson is being taught, going back, thinking about how it went, what can be improved for next time. So that's an important part of your planning as well. It needs to be included. They assist you in being physically and mentally prepared to teach. By physically, I mean you have the supplies, materials, handouts, pictures, whatever you need to teach there with you, and mentally that you know what your lesson is and how to proceed with it. They also help you with your pacing, your long-term planning especially, to make sure that your course objectives get completed before the end of the school year, but not too soon before the end of the school year. Well, for one of the first years I taught, I failed to do long-term planning in math because, after all, the lessons are all laid out there. And so I did a lesson a day, and about mid to late March realized I didn't have any lessons left. So I had gone a little bit too quickly. So long-term planning will prevent that problem as well as the other problem finding out in March that you've got half of your lessons to go yet and you don't have time for that. So that pacing is very important. The first step, I'm sorry, you're going to have to stop looking at my screensaver now. The first step is a curriculum guides. These should be provided for you by the administration, although usually teachers have a role in keeping them up and maintaining them. Basically, a curriculum guide, and I know you can't read all this, that's okay. Give you a description of the course, and you'll see in here the different goals for the course, what it is the student should be able to do. Now, objectives should be stated clearly in what it is the student can do. They need to be measurable, things that you can determine by some standard as to whether or not they've been accomplished. Curriculum guides serve to define the bounds of a teacher's freedom and flexibility as well. If there are certain things that need to get covered, they should be in the curriculum guides. And teachers often have some discretion about other matters that may or may not be included in the guides that they can bring in. That's a hard thing as an administrator, and we're, you know, one responsible for writing these. That's the balance I'm often trying to strike. I want the minimum standards in the guides. I want the teachers to be able to bring the things in that they're passionate about, that they have special experience or gifts in and knowledge in, and be able to bring those in to enrich the courses. So there's a balance there. They also should provide lists of resources. You'll see those here. I'll close this one and bring up, here's one for an eighth grade academic reading and writing course here. So you've got the skills that they're going to be learning in this course. Okay. Your next step is long-range planning. And this the teacher should do, and it doesn't have to be elaborate, but it's very necessary. This is what's going to keep you on pace and make sure that everything is covered. Here's one for, what grade is this? First grade math. This is a Saxon math. The curriculum is laid out, so just lesson numbers of what's getting covered each week is sufficient. Here's one for logic. Again, it's with lesson numbers and topics being covered each week. And this is done for each week of the school year. It's the second quarter. When you do your long-range plans, you need to work in time for catch-up, for review. You'll miss classes. You'll have the missed class because we have to have a spring music concert rehearsal, or there's field trips for another class and they're taken out of yours, and holidays, things come up, find you have to go back and reteach a lesson, spend some more time with it. So work in that time from the beginning. Some say 10% is a good guide, but on that. Another thing about long-range plans is they need to be reevaluated mid-year. Usually December, our first two quarters are finished up before Christmas break. Right before Christmas break, I ask the teachers to look over their long-term plans and let me know if there's any problems, if they're being too far behind, if we're going to have to make decisions about things being cut or whatever. Doing the long-range plans well is a big help with doing the weekly planning that you have to do throughout the year. Being able to just pull up on there basically what needs to be done, it makes it much faster. Huge difference, really, in what you do week to week then. Okay. There also can be unit plans. I don't have an example of one of those. Unit planning can be done if it's a course that lends itself to that. Perhaps you've got a grammar school science course and you have to do a unit on simple machines. It helps to have a plan of just what the objectives are that fall into that unit and a list of all the activities and labs and illustrations, all the things that you have all listed together on one plan. You don't necessarily have to write the lessons out themselves, although you might want to kind of pace out goals. If you know it's going to be 10 lessons, you might have 10 blocks and just get a general idea of what you're going to do each time. List field trips, guest speakers, anything like that. If it's grammar school, any sound off chants, that kind of thing that you're going to be teaching with that unit, have it all there together. I like to put those in one folder and have everything there in one folder that I can pick up and pull out when the time comes. You can also list in there extension activities, the things that kids can do during rainy day when you have to have indoor recess or that kind of thing. A gathering times in the morning when there's some free play, if there's items you can put out for them to use that would relate to their units. include that information as well. All right. Once you have those set up, it's great to have that folder that you can just stick other things in as you come across them during the years too. And you end up collecting quite a bit. All right, now let's look at the lesson plan itself. You have in your handout, you have a form. If you didn't get a handout, I think there's some more left in the back. By the way, all this handout, each part of it is available. There's a website address there on the front of the packet. And it's just my name, DoriZinkin.com. You can go on there and download all these. If you want to use this lesson plan form in Microsoft Word, you can download it from there, and then you can make your lessons right in the form. So this form looks like this when it's blank. Okay. And this is based on the seven laws, so that it can help you put that into your lesson planning right as you write it. Teacher subject unit and lessons, pretty self-explanatory. Objectives. You need to know what it is you want your students to be able to know or do at the end of the lesson. So you need to state your objectives clearly. They should be measurable. A goal like we want them to enjoy this literature isn't really a good goal. I mean, it's a nice broad goal, but it can't be a lesson objective because you can't measure it really at the end. So it's a good thing to want and to hope for, but it's not a great objective for a lesson plan. You won't be able to tell if you've done it. They should be stated in terms of what the students can do. So it's students will be able to add two-digit numbers that require regrouping. Okay, that's a goal you're going to be able to tell at the end of the lesson whether or not they're able to do it, which ones are able and which ones are not. It's helpful for some of your students, by the way, when you're teaching a lesson, to let them know what the objective is at the end. It's helpful for some learners to know that. Okay, for your introduction, the law of the learner tells us a learner must attend with interest to the material to be learned. You need to arouse student interest by posing a problem, asking what they already know about a subject, or relating it to their previous lessons. You want to provide context. Some learners really need context. They're not able to learn well when they can't connect it to a purpose and to what they already know. So it's a good time to do that. Vocabulary. You need to attend to the vocabulary of the lesson so that you can determine whether your students are already familiar with it or if you need to teach it. So that's something you need to put. Our law says the language used as a medium between teacher and learner must be common to both. So you need to find out what vocabulary they already know. And you need to teach the vocabulary that's necessary. This lesson section on this form is really two of the seven laws combined here. A lesson to be mastered must be explicable in terms of the truth already known by the learner, so it's known to the unknown. And teaching is arousing and using the pupil's mind to grasp the desired thought or master the desired art. So the first thing you have to do really is find out what your students know is to build on that to what it is you want them to know and what it is you want them to find out. You need to review previous lessons, perhaps, to build on this so you can go from known to unknown. And don't assume anything. You want to guide them through a process of discovery. As much as possible, have them find things out for themselves. Milton Gregory, I think, says don't do anything, don't tell them anything they can discover for themselves, and that's a good guide. Ask questions, give the students problems to solve, give information outright. Give information outright only as it's needed to guide discovery. And this is when you want to use diagrams, visual clues, verbal reasoning, maps, charts, all those things to help them fix these ideas in their memories. And then the reflection and application, you need to find a way that the student will be able to use what they've learned and practice using it. Find a way for them to rewrite or rethink or apply the information learned. This can be a discussion, it can be a worksheet, it can be a project that they need to work on, problems they need to solve. Give them time to reflect or to discuss. Provide them with practice. No matter how good your explanation is of how to do something, so let's say a math problem, some students are not going to follow the explanation, and when faced with a problem that they have to solve, are going to, for the first time, apply their minds to it. You may have been talking for 20 minutes, and until a problem is placed before them that they have to work, the whole thing is not going to make sense. It's just the way it is. There's a certain number of students that's going to be the case. As a teacher, you need to know that, and you need to be watching for it. And when you get to this application stage in your lesson where they're actually doing something, you need to be circulating among your students in order to figure out who needs help and give them just the right amount of help. Not too much, just enough. You don't want that to become a crutch where they learn to just sit there and wait for you to come and then you do the problem for them. Make sure you're not falling into that. You want to give them just enough to get them going. But you have to watch for those students. They're the ones that, you know, they're the 10% or the 20% that you're going to lose every time if you don't attend to that step. So make sure that as you do your lesson plan, you allow for that experience to happen so that you can catch those students and bring them in. Okay. Your lesson plan also needs to have a means of assessment. Let me see if it's... This is the bottom of the form here. Okay. You have to be able to determine who has learned the lesson. And I think it's an important thing. Although assessment can be informal, such as a discussion at the end of a class, you've got to remember that you're not assessing whether or not the class got the lesson. You're assessing whether each student got the lesson. And it can be falsely encouraging sometimes at the end of a lesson you have a discussion, and it's a nice, robust discussion, and a lot of kids have contributed answers, and then you're encouraged to think, okay, they got it. But maybe three or four of them didn't, the ones who didn't participate in the discussion. So you need to be very careful that as you're doing your assessment at the end of a lesson, that you know that each student, whether or not they got the point. Okay. Review also should be a part of the planning. Plan how you're going to review this even in future lessons. The next lesson you're going to do so that, and write it in this plan. I have a sample one here filled in, and a lot of you can't read the writing on it, but this was a summer math course. Here I've got objectives clearly stated. Students can define fractions as a value expressed as a numerator over a denominator. Understand the meanings of numerator and denominator. So there's the... There's the objectives clearly stated. We have an introduction leading a discussion. This is the first lesson of a summer program. Leading a discussion to find out what the students already know. Write it on the board. So I've got a plan on how I'm going to find out what it is they know already. What vocabulary then is going to be included in this discussion, whereas if these words aren't defined by the students in the course of the discussion, I'm going to make sure I add that in, that they're going to understand these terms. Here's the lesson includes the activities we're going to do. what problems I'm going to present them with. I've thought through what it is I might expect to happen and what I'm going to do about it. Okay, reflection and application problems. Talk to them about what they learned through the struggles I put them through in the lesson. Okay, each, for my assessment here, it's informal. Each kid's going to have to explain how it is they solved problems, and whether or not they were able to do that will be my assessment of their understanding in reviews. Now, you note here, I've got lesson notes afterwards. These are the things that happened with the different students, the different reactions the different kids had to what happened and the ones that were notable. And then an evaluation here on what I might want to do differently next time. Now, does every lesson have to be written out like this? No. You'd be taking way too long doing your lesson plans. But doing some like this is very helpful. It's very helpful for training yourself to do these parts, to include all these things in your lesson. So you may get a form like, you may use a form like this and just write a couple words in each block. You may not use the form. We use RenWeb also at our school. You may not know, there's those of you who use RenWeb, there's four blocks in the detail section. You can rename those however you like. We've renamed ours to fit with the seven laws. So that's something your administrator can do. They may not know it. So if you'd like to have that done, you might mention that. Okay. Let's talk about interest and balance in your lesson planning. One valuable tool is the seven laws, and that's why we have this seven law form. But you can, whether you use the form or not, reviewing the seven laws with yourself is also very helpful when you plan a lesson, so that you can get that balance and make sure you're including all that sage advice from John Milton Gregory on balancing your lesson. So that's a very helpful thing to do. Bloom's taxonomy is another tool, and I want to take a look at that. This is in your handout. Let me get this up on full screen here. They cut it off. Okay, that doesn't work well. You've got a chart that compares Bloom's taxonomy to the biblical and the classical trivium. If you went to teacher's college and learned how to be a teacher, then you know about Bloom's taxonomy. And so the rest of you, if you would bear with me while I explain it to the rest. Bloom's taxonomy really describes different levels of higher levels of thinking. It's a good way to organize. It helps teachers to be pushing their kids up the scale, really, to higher levels of thinking. It correlates extremely well with the trivium. It's a six-stage program, but it fits like a glove with the three stages of the trivium, where knowledge and comprehension at the first two levels are very much our grammar stage. Application and analysis fit well with the logic dialectic stage, or in biblical terms is understanding. And then wisdom and rhetoric fit well with evaluation and synthesis. Sometimes you see the synthesis and then evaluation, vice versa. To me, it makes sense to have evaluation first, because you can't synthesize sources until you know which sources are worthy of synthesizing, but there you go. In your handout, you'll see a typical chart, and these are all over the internet, and there's lots of teacher resources that make use of Bloom's taxonomy. But it gives you some examples of discussion questions at the different levels and activities, the kinds of activities that a student might be required to do. So if you're looking for ideas and you're kind of dried up as to how am I going to teach this lesson, this is a good thing to look at. Find activities that are appropriate to your level of the trivium. Push them up a little bit. So you may find that helpful. Another thing that's helpful in well-balanced lesson plans is considering learning styles, learning pathways. We just need to be careful that when we get that, we're looking at this with a biblical and correct worldview. Learning styles are not disabilities. They're not excuses for not being able to do your work. They're a set of skills and preferences that a student already has as a means of learning. Ideally, we would like students to be able to learn through as many learning pathways as possible, because then throughout their lives they're going to be in all sorts of different learning situations. They may have to learn from a book, they may have to learn from a lecture, they may be able to get the DVD, they may be able to get the CD. There's going to be lectures, halls, and colleges. The ideal thing is to be able to learn it through as many ways as possible. Studies have found that when teachers teach with a mind to learning styles, so that they're reaching as big a variety as they can within their lesson, not aiming it toward each child, but just the whole lesson incorporating as many learning pathways as possible, all students learn better. So that's one thing that we can take from this that can happen. And it doesn't matter which study, which model you use. There are several different models out there for this thing. One of the researchers who really came to that conclusion had their own model, and they really ended up commendably, honestly, coming to the conclusion that their model was no better than any other as far as driving teachers' instruction and informing teachers' instruction. So pick your favorite model, doesn't matter. But if you look at, am I presenting material visually? Am I having the students write it, see it, hear it, speak it? So that's another model, another way to look at your lessons and see that you're giving a good variety. Evaluation of lesson plans. Again, I have something in your handout here. If you look at your own lesson plans, you can evaluate these, or if you're an administrator and have to evaluate lessons that you're observing. By the way, I highly recommend teachers going to other teachers' classes and watching others teach. You learn so much that way, and you can help them. I had the blessing one year of teaching, team teaching a class, a first grade class with another teacher, and we kind of made the habit of, I would sit in the back of the room while she was teaching sometimes, and she would do that for me. And it's amazing how much we picked up on to help each other. Things that were going on in the back of the room that we had no idea were going on in the back of the room. And you can see sometimes when another person is teaching when the students are lost, and you can pick up that on that and share with each other. So you can be both a benefit to the teacher you're observing and learn a lot from how he or she teaches. So that's a good habit to get into. I know we're really pressed for time during the school day, but that's a very helpful thing. And it's not threatening because it's just another teacher. It's not going to show up on their performance review or anything like that. Okay. So as you evaluate lesson plans, evaluate them according to the seven laws. I have some guidelines here, making sure that the objectives are clear and measurable making sure you have a fullness of knowledge as you teach the subject. Evaluate student interest, whether connections are made and context provided, and whether or not the students are able from this lesson to understand why what they're learning is important or lovely or good. Assess the language that was used, whether or not you've had a means to assess their current vocabulary, whether or not new vocabulary is adequately taught. Make sure you're not assuming what students know, but that you do have a means for determining it. That fractions class I showed you a lesson plan for earlier, one of the lessons we were going through multiplication and division of fractions and trying to help the students understand when you multiply and when you divide. And one of the students in the class was younger than the others. This was a summer course. It was elective. She was quite a bit younger than the others, and she was younger than what the course would allow, but she was a gifted math student. Besides, she was the administrator's daughter, granddaughter, so what can I do? But she was a lovely girl. I was trying to explain a concept, and I had to go at it over and over and over, and she just wasn't getting it. And I didn't understand it because she was really has a wonderful math brain. And I realized I was using a dot for a multiplication sign instead of an X with a child that was too young to have been introduced to that. She thought I was shorthanding a division sign. So every time she thought I was talking about multiplication, or she thought I was talking about division when I was talking about multiplication. So that's just an example here of the law of the language. That's the law I violated there. I was using a symbol. It wasn't a word, but it was a symbol that just was not known to the student. There was a real lesson to be learned there. So as you assess your lessons, you just don't assume. Don't assume what they know. Okay. Students are discoverers. Take a look at the lesson. Are they really discoverers? Are they finding things out, working things out for themselves? Was there a means for them to reproduce in their own mind the truth that was to be learned? Did they rewrite, rethink, evaluate? And then the test and proof of the lesson done is the review, rethinking, renewing, reproducing. Make sure that they've had an opportunity to do that. Okay, also evaluate lessons by their effectiveness of applying the trivium. Were they appropriate to the stages that the students were in? And there's examples here on this evaluation sheet of the kinds of activities that are appropriate, kinds of lessons that are appropriate to the different stages. And you've also got here advice on balancing learning pathways. Let me go over those a little bit because we didn't talk about that so much. An opportunity for active learning. We want active learners. They need to do something with the information or discuss it with others. Make sure there's an opportunity for reflection, that is, time for thinking things through or writing a response. You notice there's kind of two different kinds of people. There's some that want to just be quiet a second and let me think as they work something out, and others who just want to talk it out, and as they discuss, they figure it out. Others don't want to discuss until they figured it out. So you'll... I don't know if I need it anyway. So you want to allow for both in your lessons. Things like journaling, writing things out, writing down their impressions, doing a short little essay at the end of a lesson. This is a reflective activity that helps people kind of go off by themselves and think. Discussion is something that will serve those who need to learn actively. You can also do both. Do one, give them time to reflect, which primes them for discussion. or vice versa. Discussion can prime reflection. Abstract concepts are taught using concrete examples, and students are given an opportunity to explore real-world connections. Very often, if I'm teaching math, I'll often go back to examples using integers, just plain old numbers. I mean, I'm teaching fractions, I'll start with the same concept with whole numbers. If I'm teaching something with algebra, it's got variables in it, go back to with numbers. Well, what would you do if this was just numbers? And they can easily see that they can learn to distribute when they multiply 3 times 8. Is it really 3 times 6 plus 3 times 2? Does that work with numbers that we know? Once they know it works with numbers they know, they can go back, and then you can use variables and apply the same concept, and it makes more sense. So that's just an example, but as we anecdotes, stories that make things more real are very important to add in. Make sure that information is presented visually as much as possible. Pictures, diagrams, writing keywords on the board. Very simple habit to get to write keywords on the board as you talk. And it's very helpful to some of the students. Students are given an opportunity to process information verbally by summarizing in their own words, writing reports, discussing, explaining something to others. Very important. Make sure they're given the big picture of the lesson and how it relates to other lessons and other information. It's very helpful at the beginning of a lesson to tell students what's going to happen and then at the end summarize what just did happen. Okay. Just make sure students are given an opportunity for metacognition, that is, to think or talk about the mental processes or methods they're using to solve problems. How did you solve that problem? How did you go about it? That kind of thought process really helps cement what was learned, and it helps reveal to other students how problems are solved. Okay, and push students to discover applications and connections and to consider alternatives. Take the lesson a little further. Okay. Now this is about all I have, and I have got a lot of time left. So if you would like to ask questions, let's see if I can help. Yes, ma'am. Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah, we went through that too. The question was, we just went to RenWeb, and teachers are feeling like they have to do things twice because they have to do the old paper way and then do the RenWeb way. There's definitely a transition time involved, and it's mental. But I would encourage you to just give up the paper. One thing you can do with RenWeb is you can upload documents. So if you really want to use the paper lesson plan, you can always upload a document to that lesson, and there it is. But you don't have to do that. The beauty of putting it in on RenWeb rather than on a piece of paper is that you're going to have them next year right there for you. And you can just reuse the same lesson plans. So that's an encouragement for people to go ahead and use it. You can also print them out and still have a paper in front of you as you do your lesson. So if you're just not as comfortable working off the laptop or off the computer screen and want a paper lesson plan, you can do that. So a lot of it is just kind of getting over that mental idea of what lesson plans look like and being able to transition to another form. It's the same information, it's just in a little bit different form. And there's an awful lot you can do with them. But when we transitioned, we had a lot of teachers that just stuck with the paper the first year. And then at the end of the year, when everyone else uploaded their lessons for the next year, we had a lot of converts. So just stick with it. I think it'll be a blessing in the end. Yes.
Classes that are, say, literature as opposed to
Yeah, okay. The question, for those who couldn't hear it, was about classes, for example, literature, where is there a looser a method of communicating what it is you want to accomplish, whatever, on a lesson plan? And the answer is yes, the objectives are going to look very different. But still you should have in mind what type of skill it is that they're going to be practicing. Probably they're going to be, you're not so focusing on what conclusions they reach at the end, but on what skills. So if, for example, if it's an interpretive discussion of a piece of literature, you want them to be able, you know, to interpret. You should be able to write goals as to what general areas you want them to be able to be doing, and something that you can measure. But yes, the goals for a class like that are going to look very different than a math class where it's they can successfully determine whether a problem involves multiplication or division of fractions. It's going to be a very different, less hard of a goal, but it still should be measurable. You still should be able to see if they're able to participate in a discussion, if they're, yeah. So, even in classes like that, you don't want the goal to simply be to get through that book or to read that book or to know that book. You want them to be able to practice certain interpretive skills, analytical reading skills, those kinds of things that should be applied to that book. And so that's what you want your goals to focus on in upper grades. In lower grades, you may be more concerned that they be able to repeat details, but if you're really studying literature, you don't want it to just become a grammar lesson where they're repeating the details of the story. You want them to know what details are important and why. Anything else? Yes, sir. That's for a one-day lesson. Yeah, you could do. If I was writing a lesson for every lesson that I do that week, which I would rarely do, but if I was doing that, I'd use seven of them, you know, or five of them. Yeah, to do the lesson. Yeah, I wouldn't. I don't think I'd try to fit a week on this form. Now, you could devise another form for that, if that's what you're comfortable with. The forms, remember, all these things serve you. You're the teacher. You're the one who the lesson plan is helping. So write a form that fits the way you think and the way you're able to do your lessons. And if you want to do a week on a form, that's easy to do, too. You know. Yes, ma'am. Mm-hmm. A difference in the way you do the lesson plan? I would say that probably the difference is on the application. The biggest difference is going to be the application of the trivium to whatever level you're teaching. So that you're going to find, the question, let me repeat the question, I'm sorry. Are these lesson plans different essentially than what would be taught in a school that's not a classical school? How do we distinguish the classical school from others? The essential difference is going to be how the material of the lesson applies to the trivium for the level that you're teaching. If it's a grammar class, it's going to be focused on the grammar. If it's a dialectic level class, it's going to be focused on dialectic level skills. As you get up into dialectic and rhetoric levels, you're going to find less and less focus on information and more focus on the skills of those students to manipulate that information, to analyze it, to produce their own... Oh, you get my desktop again. Produce their own... their own analysis of it, to present it and communicate it. So the goals are mostly what's going to be very different. Yeah. And that'll drive the methods you use to teach those things, because you teach skills a lot differently than you teach information. Yes, sir. That's right.
Rather than just teaching them information, most public schools now are doing, they're just giving them information, expecting the students to know that information and give them that. That's a good education. We're expecting the students to learn how to think and to learn for themselves so that they don't necessarily need a teacher. The idea is that you're trying to teach yourself how to be. So when your students graduate, they can say, I can learn these things with or without a teacher.
That's right. And as you go up the trivium, the material that they're studying is more or less fodder. It's what you're using to learn the skills, so that the information itself becomes less important. And you'll see most public schools that it's kind of grammar K-12, and they'll add this critical thinking in as sort of a little add-on, like it's a different subject, and you'll see it added in even down to kindergarten. All the way up, you'll see critical thinking books and lessons and things that teachers can do to teach critical thinking. In a classical school, that teaching them to think is one of the main goals. It's the thing, and the other stuff is the add-on. I mean, what books you read and all, it becomes just a means. It's grist for the mill. It's what they practice their skills on. In the process, they become familiar with the Western heritage and the great conversation that's out there, and that's a very important thing too. But the primary driving goals are these dialectic and rhetoric level skills that we want them to accomplish. We want them to leave us and be able to learn whatever they need to learn and whatever calling God has for them after they leave us, whether or not they have a teacher to do it. Anything else? Okay. Well, I'm letting you out 10 minutes early. Godspeed. Thank you.